listening test. You will hear a number of different recordings, and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. There will be time for you to read the instructions and questions. And you'll have time to check your work. At the start of each recording you'll hear this sound. You will hear each recording twice. The test is in four parts. At the end of the test, you'll be given 2 minutes to check your answers. Part 1. You're going to listen to the recording. Before you listen, you'll have 20 seconds to read the instruction carefully. And you'll listen to the piece twice.
Hello, this is Land Transport Information at Toronto Airport. How may I help you?
Oh, good morning. I'm flying to Toronto Airport next week and I need to get to a town called, Milton. Could you tell me how I can get there?
Milton, did you say? Let me see. I think that's about 150 miles southwest of here. In fact, it's 147 miles to be exact. So it'll take you at least, say, 3 to 4 hours by road.
Wow! Is it as far as that?
Yes, I'm afraid so. But you have a number of options to get you there, and you can always rent a car right here at the airport, of course.
Right. Well, I don't really want to drive myself, so I'd like more information about public transport.
Okay. In that case, the quickest and most comfortable is a cab. And, of course, there are always plenty available, but it'll cost you. You can also take a Greyhound bus, or there's an airport shuttle service to Milton.
I think for that kind of distance, a cab would be way beyond my budget. But the bus sounds okay. Can you tell me how much that would cost?
Sure. Let's see. That would be $15 one way, or $27.50 return. That's on the Greyhound.
Ah, that's quite cheap. Great. Whereabouts does it stop in Milton?
It goes directly from the airport here to the city center, and it's pretty fast. But you have to bear in mind that there is only one departure a day, so it depends what time your flight gets in.
Ah, of course. Hang on. Oh, we're due to get there at 11:30 a.m.
Too bad. The bus leaves at 3:45. So you would have quite a wait, more than 4 hours.
Oh, I see. Well, what about the shuttle you mentioned?
Okay, that's the airport shuttle that will take you from the airport right to your hotel or private address. It's a door-to-door service, and it would suit you much better because there's one every 2 hours.
So how much does that cost?
Let's see. Yeah, that's $35 one way, $65 return. So I guess it's a bit more expensive than the Greyhound.
Oh, that doesn't sound too bad, especially if it'll take me straight to the hotel.
But you do need to reserve a seat.
Okay. Is it possible to make a booking right now, through you?
Sure.
Now, listen to part one again.
Hello, this is Land Transport Information at Toronto Airport. How may I help you?
Oh, good morning. I'm flying to Toronto Airport next week, and I need to get to a town called, Milton. Could you tell me how I can get there?
Milton, did you say? Let me see. I think that's about 150 miles southwest of here. In fact, it's 147 miles, to be exact. So it'll take you at least, say, 3 to 4 hours by road.
Wow! Is it as far as that?
Yes, I'm afraid so. But you have a number of options to get you there, and you can always rent a car right here at the airport, of course.
Right. Well, I don't really want to drive myself, so I'd like more information about public transport.
Okay. In that case, the quickest and most comfortable is a cab, and of course there are always plenty available, but it'll cost you. You can also take a Greyhound bus, or there's an airport shuttle service to Milton.
I think for that kind of distance, a cab would be way beyond my budget. But the bus sounds okay. Can you tell me how much that would cost?
Sure. Let's see, that would be $15 one way or $27.50 return. That's on the Greyhound.
Ah, that's quite cheap. Great. Whereabouts does it stop in Milton?
It goes directly from the airport here to the city center, and it's pretty fast. But you have to bear in mind that there is only one departure a day, so it depends what time your flight gets in.
Ah, of course. Hang on. Oh, we're due to get there at 11:30 a.m.
Too bad. The bus leaves at 3:45, so you would have quite a wait, more than 4 hours.
Oh, I see. Well, what about the shuttle you mentioned?
Okay. That's the airport shuttle that will take you from the airport right to your hotel or private address. It's a door-to-door service, and it would suit you much better because there's one every 2 hours.
So how much does that cost?
Let's see. Yeah, that's $35 one way, $65 return. So I guess it's a bit more expensive than the Greyhound.
Oh, that doesn't sound too bad, especially if it'll take me straight to the hotel.
But you do need to reserve a seat.
Okay. Is it possible to make a booking right now, through you?
Sure.
Part 2. You're going to listen to another recording. Again, before you listen, you'll have 20 seconds to read the instruction carefully. And you'll listen to the piece twice.
The fourth industrial revolution has begun, and you have the chance to be part of it. This isn't going to be like before. It's not about the steam that powered our factories in the first revolution, or the mass production model that dominated the second, or even the emergence of computer-driven systems from the third revolution that we're living in today. Industry 4.0 is about connectivity. It's an opportunity to radically change the way industry responds to the needs of society. As previous industrial revolutions were led by innovations in manufacturing processes and systems, the advancement of Industry 4.0 will be driven by a smart, interconnected, pervasive environment. The opportunities for disruption are huge, and those left behind will feel it acutely. There is still space for leaders of this new revolution to emerge, but the race has already started. Understanding what current leaders are doing will help you join them. KPMG formally examined what those trailblazers were doing in their factories and their offices, and it revealed some thought-provoking findings. Our research highlighted a number of areas that current Industry 4.0 leaders are focusing on. Leaders are planning ahead with clear strategic vision. Driven by performance and tying investment to proven opportunities for growth, progress, and innovation, they are focused on discovering how smart products and processes can be developed. Integration is key. The major players are moving away from isolated silo-driven development, which limits scope and value of new projects. Instead, they are moving towards large-scale and proactive integration across their enterprise and among their customers, supply base, and products. To ensure they are aware of every possible opportunity Industry 4.0 technology has to offer. Perhaps most importantly, they are not afraid to think big and act bold. This means nurturing innovation, developing disruptive thought processes aimed at devastating the status quo, and looking for opportunity in every element of their value chain, from which products are designed and how they are produced, to who they are sold to and how they are purchased. Your organization may be radically different in the future, with a range of products, services, and processes you can't currently predict. Do you want to join the leaders of Industry 4.0? Can you afford not to? Then our advice is, plan ahead. Fight radical change with integrated radical action. And embrace the fact that it's time for manufacturers to step up and start making smart, bold moves. If you don't, you could be left behind. You have this chance. Let us help you take it.
Now listen to part two again.
The fourth industrial revolution has begun, and you have the chance to be part of it. This isn't going to be like before. It's not about the steam that powered our factories in the first revolution, or the mass production model that dominated the second, or even the emergence of computer-driven systems from the third revolution that we're living in today. Industry 4.0 is about connectivity. It's an opportunity to radically change the way industry responds to the needs of society. As previous industrial revolutions were led by innovations in manufacturing processes and systems, the advancement of Industry 4.0 will be driven by a smart, interconnected, pervasive environment. The opportunities for disruption are huge, and those left behind will feel it acutely. There is still space for leaders of this new revolution to emerge, but the race has already started. Understanding what current leaders are doing will help you join them. KPMG formally examined what those trailblazers were doing in their factories and their offices, and it revealed some thought-provoking findings. Our research highlighted a number of areas that current Industry 4.0 leaders are focusing on. Leaders are planning ahead with clear strategic vision. Driven by performance and tying investment to proven opportunities for growth, progress, and innovation, they are focused on discovering how smart products and processes can be developed. Integration is key. The major players are moving away from isolated silo-driven development, which limits scope and value of new projects. Instead, they are moving towards large-scale and proactive integration across their enterprise and among their customers, supply base, and products. To ensure they are aware of every possible opportunity Industry 4.0 technology has to offer. Perhaps most importantly, they are not afraid to think big and act bold. This means nurturing innovation, developing disruptive thought processes aimed at devastating the status quo, and looking for opportunity in every element of their value chain, from which products are designed and how they are produced, to who they are sold to and how they are purchased. Your organization may be radically different in the future, with a range of products, services, and processes you can't currently predict. Do you want to join the leaders of Industry 4.0? Can you afford not to? Then our advice is, plan ahead. Fight radical change with integrated radical action. And embrace the fact that it's time for manufacturers to step up and start making smart, bold moves. If you don't, you could be left behind. You have this chance. Let us help you take it.
Part 3. You're going to listen to another recording. Again, before you listen, you'll have 20 seconds to read the instruction carefully. and you'll listen to the piece twice.
In the studio tonight, I have the sociologist John Ferrandale and philosopher Lois Granger, and we're going to be discussing attitudes towards work. Tonight's discussion was prompted by an email from a listener who, amongst other things, asks why people tend to become depressed if made redundant, as if work were the be-all and end-all, rather than seeing that situation as an opportunity to do something else. John.
Well, it can't be denied, I'm afraid, that unemployment is one of those misfortunes like soured relationships and chronic pain that most affect long-term happiness. Work is good because it gives people meaning, self-respect, and the chance to make a contribution. Unemployment, conversely, robs them of all that, which can come as a blow. So while I don't doubt, as our listener suggests, that there are people out there who might cope well with redundancy, see it as a chance to change direction or whatever, for the majority, the opposite is the case. I mean, that's the reality, isn't it, Lois?
Well, one rarely meets anyone embracing redundancy, John, but I guess what our listener is getting at is the fact that paid employment isn't the sole provider of purpose, self-worth, and engagement, and I go along with that to an extent. Indeed, a job can work against us if the experience is tedious and it feels irrelevant. Work is vital to your happiness if work is what you want, and if it's fulfilling. But we mustn't forget that tying too close a knot between meaningful activity and paid employment can be perilous, as we know from people who lose all sense of meaning when they retire. And this can affect those who love their jobs just as much as those who see them as a means to an end.
And indeed, there are people like that who view work simply as that, a way of funding other things they want, as opposed to something that holds intrinsic value. Doing a well-paid job that lacks excitement, but one which allows you to do exciting things in your spare time, might work perfectly well for some, and I'd say good luck to them as long as they get on with the job whilst they're there. Where's the harm in it? But I'd say it's preferable to earn less doing something you love, because work actually takes up an awful lot of your waking life. But if you want the good things in life and haven't found the kind of meaningful work that can provide them directly, then you have some thinking to do. The trade-offs are treacherous, and some of what you value may have to be sacrificed along the way.
You mention attitudes to work, John. We do tend to come down heavily on slackers, people who don't pull their weight, don't we?
We do, and amongst the many career options we have to choose from, one is almost taboo. As the listener who suggested this week's topic put it, someone tempted to work as little as possible is likely to be afraid of being judged as a useless slacker. This taboo seems to have grown as our work options have multiplied. Now, work is no longer destiny, determined at birth by the social standing of your parents. How we earn a living reflects more of our individual qualities and choices, and we're judged accordingly. But perhaps these judgments are distorted by confusing sound reasons for thinking work is important with the false belief that honest labour is inherently virtuous.
That's right. I mean, think of Freud, the famous psychoanalyst who's widely attributed with the quote, "Love and work are the cornerstones of our humanness." Although it's actually a paraphrase by Erikson. What Freud actually said is that the compulsion to work was created by external necessity. In other words, the imperative to work springs from practical demands, not immutable psychic needs. There's nothing valuable in work per se. Indeed, the philosopher Bertrand Russell went so far as to claim that immense harm is caused by the belief that work is virtuous. That if we work more than we need to, we deprive ourselves of the time and opportunity for learning, self-development, relationships, and many other things that make for a better world. If we must work, or choose to do so, what matters is that it serves the goal of living well, rather than detracts from it.
At that point, I'd like to bring in...
Now listen to part three again.
In the studio tonight, I have the sociologist John Ferrandale and philosopher Lois Granger, and we're going to be discussing attitudes towards work. Tonight's discussion was prompted by an email from a listener who, amongst other things, asks why people tend to become depressed if made redundant, as if work were the be-all and end-all, rather than seeing that situation as an opportunity to do something else. John?
Well, it can't be denied, I'm afraid, that unemployment is one of those misfortunes like soured relationships and chronic pain that most affect long-term happiness. Work is good because it gives people meaning, self-respect, and the chance to make a contribution. Unemployment, conversely, robs them of all that, which can come as a blow. So while I don't doubt, as our listener suggests, that there are people out there who might cope well with redundancy, see it as a chance to change direction or whatever, for the majority, the opposite is the case. I mean, that's the reality, isn't it, Lois?
Well, one rarely meets anyone embracing redundancy, John, but I guess what our listener is getting at is the fact that paid employment isn't the sole provider of purpose, self-worth, and engagement, and I go along with that to an extent. Indeed, a job can work against us if the experience is tedious and it feels irrelevant. Work is vital to your happiness if work is what you want, and if it's fulfilling. But we mustn't forget that tying too close a knot between meaningful activity and paid employment can be perilous, as we know from people who lose all sense of meaning when they retire. And this can affect those who love their jobs just as much as those who see them as a means to an end.
And indeed, there are people like that who view work simply as that, a way of funding other things they want, as opposed to something that holds intrinsic value. Doing a well-paid job that lacks excitement, but one which allows you to do exciting things in your spare time, might work perfectly well for some, and I'd say good luck to them as long as they get on with the job whilst they're there. Where's the harm in it? But I'd say it's preferable to earn less doing something you love, because work actually takes up an awful lot of your waking life. But if you want the good things in life and haven't found the kind of meaningful work that can provide them directly, then you have some thinking to do. The trade-offs are treacherous, and some of what you value may have to be sacrificed along the way.
You mention attitudes to work, John. We do tend to come down heavily on slackers, people who don't pull their weight, don't we?
We do, and amongst the many career options we have to choose from, one is almost taboo. As the listener who suggested this week's topic put it, someone tempted to work as little as possible is likely to be afraid of being judged as a useless slacker. This taboo seems to have grown as our work options have multiplied. Now, work is no longer destiny, determined at birth by the social standing of your parents. How we earn a living reflects more of our individual qualities and choices, and we're judged accordingly. But perhaps these judgments are distorted by confusing sound reasons for thinking work is important with the false belief that honest labour is inherently virtuous.
That's right. I mean, think of Freud, the famous psychoanalyst who's widely attributed with the quote, "Love and work are the cornerstones of our humanness." Although it's actually a paraphrase by Erikson. What Freud actually said is that the compulsion to work was created by external necessity. In other words, the imperative to work springs from practical demands, not immutable psychic needs. There's nothing valuable in work per se. Indeed, the philosopher Bertrand Russell went so far as to claim that immense harm is caused by the belief that work is virtuous. That if we work more than we need to, we deprive ourselves of the time and opportunity for learning, self-development, relationships, and many other things that make for a better world. If we must work, or choose to do so, what matters is that it serves the goal of living well, rather than detracts from it.
At that point, I'd like to bring in...
That's the end of part 3. You now have 30 seconds to check your answers. Part 4. You're going to listen to the final recording. Again, before you listen, you'll have 20 seconds to read the instruction carefully. And you'll listen to the piece twice.
Internet browsing is not conceivable without search engines. The various web pages which help us find our way around the stupendous amount of cyber locations in the World Wide Web. And since the early 90s, hundreds of search engines have come and gone. One, however, has achieved a kind of success that even new tech giants Microsoft are envious of. Its name has become synonymous with the verb search. Anna Mills has the report.
He may seem the most powerful man on the planet, but Bill Gates has not yet managed the ultimate achievement in the new technology industry, turning a product into a common word. The first such honour is falling to Google, the internet search engine devised by two Stanford PhD nerds, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. The success of Google has come about through the most timeless form of marketing, word of mouth. The site has for some time been the default tool for millions of people looking for anything they want to find online, from obscure quotations to brass lamps. And there are increasing signs that the business is growing a commercial sharpness to match the blade it uses to cut through internet junk. Last week, Google secured a place as the Internet Search Engine for America Online, the world's largest service provider, capping its stealthy rise to the top. But its success stretches far beyond the world of the Internet. In these dog days of the long university summer break, I was up in the nearly deserted university library when I heard one professor say to another, "Me? I'm just Googling around." I knew what he meant. It wasn't that he was totally idle, but he wasn't really engaged in sharply focused research either. He was following leads from one source to another, happily wandering through the archive, not knowing quite what he would find next. Google, the search engine favoured by most academics, seems destined to be one of those proprietary labels that becomes a word, a brand, like Hoover, that loses its initial capital letter. And the word itself is, slowly but surely, replacing the verb to browse, the paper-based metaphor that electronic catalogues use, as if you were fingering the spines at some antiquarian bookstall. Googling is a different kind of sampling, coming across relevant findings amongst an impossibly huge amount of information. The company name is a corruption of Google, spelt G-O-O-G-O-L, the word apparently coined by the 9-year-old nephew of American mathematician Edward Kasner to refer to the number represented by 1 followed by 100 zeros, back in the 1940s. Little did he know that in the early 21st century, the use of the term would become so commonplace amongst academics and laymen alike.
Now listen to part 4 again.
Internet browsing is not conceivable without search engines. The various web pages which help us find our way around the stupendous amount of cyber locations in the World Wide Web. And since the early 90s, hundreds of search engines have come and gone. One, however, has achieved a kind of success that even new tech giants Microsoft are envious of. Its name has become synonymous with the verb search. Anna Mills has the report.
He may seem the most powerful man on the planet, but Bill Gates has not yet managed the ultimate achievement in the new technology industry, turning a product into a common word. The first such honour is falling to Google, the internet search engine devised by two Stanford PhD nerds, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. The success of Google has come about through the most timeless form of marketing, word of mouth. The site has for some time been the default tool for millions of people looking for anything they want to find online, from obscure quotations to brass lamps. And there are increasing signs that the business is growing a commercial sharpness to match the blade it uses to cut through internet junk. Last week, Google secured a place as the Internet Search Engine for America Online, the world's largest service provider, capping its stealthy rise to the top. But its success stretches far beyond the world of the internet. In these dog days of the long university summer break, I was up in the nearly deserted university library when I heard one professor say to another, "Me? I'm just Googling around." I knew what he meant. It wasn't that he was totally idle, but he wasn't really engaged in sharply focused research either. He was following leads from one source to another, happily wandering through the archive, not knowing quite what he would find next. Google, the search engine favoured by most academics, seems destined to be one of those proprietary labels that becomes a word, a brand, like Hoover, that loses its initial capital letter. And the word itself is, slowly but surely, replacing the verb to browse, the paper-based metaphor that electronic catalogues use, as if you were fingering the spines at some antiquarian bookstall. Googling is a different kind of sampling, coming across relevant findings amongst an impossibly huge amount of information. The company name is a corruption of Google, spelt G-O-O-G-O-L, the word apparently coined by the 9-year-old nephew of American mathematician Edward Kasner to refer to the number represented by 1 followed by 100 zeros, back in the 1940s. Little did he know that in the early 21st century, the use of the term would become so commonplace amongst academics and laymen alike.
That's the end of the listening section. You now have 2 minutes to check all your answers.
Time's up. Thank you.